Hello everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where I, Rod Jones, content manager, and Kate Cooper, head of research policy and standards at the Institute, take a critical look at what's been happening in the world of leadership and management up to the 31st of August 2020. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Well, our first story, Kate, asks, what does the John Lewis overhaul tell us about leading change? John Lewis chair Dame Sharon White has revealed that the retailer is on the brink of scrapping its never knowingly undersold strapline, first adopted in 1925. In an interview with the Sunday Times, White said, "The proposition is important because it signifies being first to society. We're reviewing it to improve it. As a potential replacement," she suggested, "my money's on fair value for all." The shift is part of a wide-ranging change mission that White is leading at the retail brand, which was already facing challenges before the pandemic. Last year, the firm recorded its first ever half-year loss, which shook the profit-sharing scheme that underpinned the brand's employee-owned partnership model. Commenting on White's Sunday Times interview in a piece on the online arm of Campaign, Joe Delaney, strategy director at creative agency Odd London, said that under Sharon White's new guidance, the leadership team are finally showing a serious commitment to change. Axing something that's been in place for 95 years is a roaring statement of intent. Kate, what can leaders learn from John Lewis's multifaceted issues about the challenges of leading change?
As a very loyal John Lewis shopper myself for decades, actually, in the days before price comparison websites, John Lewis, for their never knowingly undersold strapline, were competing with stores next door, only miles away, not a global marketplace. So the fact that that is going is not at all surprising, because these are not a pile them high, sell them cheap sort of retailer. This is a retailer that really prizes itself on customer service and being fair to its employees, all of those things that make for a great brand. So yes, it is time for a change. They're moving, I think, towards value for all, which of course is in line with stakeholder capitalism, about everybody in the value chain having to be adequately rewarded. So they're definitely moving with the times. But of course, Sharon has these real challenges, because some things she just has to change to keep up, and they are outside the control of John Lewis. But the things that are inside the control of John Lewis, of course, the culture of the organisation, how they treat their staff, loyal staff, many have been there for many years, will be threatened by anything that seems different. But I think what we have to remember, when people understand the why, the purpose of the change, as we've seen in the last few months with COVID and home working, goodness me, can't they be adaptable?
Thank you, Kate. Our next story looks at the ethical lessons from furlough misuse. Almost two-thirds of employees furloughed under the coronavirus job retention scheme in the UK continued to work in April and May, despite the scheme's strict requirement for beneficiaries to down tools. In the largest study so far of UK organisations' practical handling of the government's employment contingency, researchers at the University of Oxford, Cambridge and Zurich found that not all workers are furloughed equally, and that misuse of the scheme has been widespread. Most concerning is that the researchers discovered 19% of the total study sample report being explicitly asked to work by their employer despite being currently furloughed, and many more furloughed employees report working even if not explicitly compelled to do so by their employer, suggesting that the staff feel duty bound to carry on working, perhaps to keep face with their bosses. Speaking to Mail Online, Crossland Employment Solicitors Director Beverly Sutherland said, "Some people have been saying that their employer has given them a 20% pay cut, but they are still expected to work. Employees are having their salaries paid by the government and are still getting all the work done." Kate, what are the ethical lessons that leaders should take away from this?
This is incredibly timely, because of course today, and it will be available for the podcast listeners to download, Raymond Madden is actually asking that question about ethics. How ethical are we? And I think the answer to this is not at all ethical. And if you take that very simple definition of ethical behaviour, is what you do when nobody's looking, it's fraud. And maybe the short-term expediency, we don't know what's going to happen, these grants are available, let to take them. As senior leadership teams overlook the messages that they're sending out about ethical behaviour, about integrity, and you'll either get employees who start replicating those sorts of unethical behaviours, which is absolutely what you wouldn't want, or, as we found with our values research, people who want to work for a company whose values align with their own will really not be happy working in these organisations. So what might be a short-term solution to cash flow problems might, in the longer term, give them much greater problems.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story also continues the COVID theme, and it's a story that looks at a snapshot poll that reports in Insight that commuting, not COVID, is the main reason employees are avoiding offices. The results come as analysis from US bank Morgan Stanley showed only one third of UK white collar employees have gone back to work, lagging far behind their European counterparts, where twice as many have done so. A previous eDay survey showed that one in three UK workers are reluctant to return to office spaces at all now that lockdown measures have been erased, and that 63% felt they were more productive working from home anyway. Steve Arnold, CEO of eDays, commented, "As more staff to return to work, companies need to ensure the time employees do spend in the office is as stress-free as possible. This means being aware of what your staff members' concerns actually are and how you can help address them, and building in more flexibility to where people do their best work, or making sure that those who like to start earlier or finish later are allowed to do so will also help." Kate, how does this survey match up with the UK government this week asking employees to return to work to support the economy?
Well, it doesn't really, does it, Rod? And I think the telling statistic there is 63% of people feel they're more productive at home, and so many don't like commuting. And we have known for so long that that control, that autonomy over your working day makes for better work-life balance, more contented employees, and, as we've seen here, more productive employees. And it seems ironic in a way that we're being encouraged that when we've made people commute and go into work, or we're being required here by Steve Arnold to make their days as stress-free as possible. Now, the stress appears to be the commuting to get there. So many other businesses rely on people going to offices. So we have the transport, we have food suppliers, we have cleaning firms, all of those activities that need people in offices. So you can understand why, by staying at home, it's having a greater significance on the economy than just somebody avoiding their daily commute. So it is a difficult one, but I think what we have to do as leaders and managers is balance the needs of the individual, understand their particular concerns against those of the organisation, and somehow arrive at something that nobody feels hard done by or being made to do something that they're not happy with. And that can only happen at an individual level. Impossible, I think, to have sort of blanket decisions about this that affect hundreds of people.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story asks if contextual recruitment is now more important than ever. Amid significant turbulence around the process for awarding grades to 2020's pandemic-disrupted A-level graduates, two of the world's biggest law firms have announced dramatic shifts in their UK recruitment policies. DWF revealed that it would no longer set specific A-level or Scottish High requirements for graduate recruits, and would instead pursue a strategy of contextual recruitment in a bid to woo a more diverse talent pool and boost social mobility. And city-based firm Asher said it has dropped A-level stipulations for training contract seekers on the grounds that gamified assessments of cognitive ability, problem-solving and emotional intelligence are a more accurate predictor of workplace effectiveness. In an Evening Standard column earlier this month, Sir Peter Lampl, founder and chair of social mobility charity The Sutton Trust, argued that contextual recruitment will be key to helping young people ride out the current crisis. "We need to look past A-level grades and degrees," he stressed, "and make every effort to give due weight to young people's characters and values and propensity for hard work." Kate, would you agree with Sir Peter's comments?
We have to look at A-level grades and degrees, but not in the very narrow way that so many companies have been certain number of points at A level, certain number of A stars, having to go to certain universities, and actually following a course of study, whether it's A levels, whether it's BTEC National, whether it's an apprenticeship, whether it's an international baccalaureate, says something about that individual. But what we want is diversity. And I think if we keep confine our talent pool to that very small group of high A level achievers, when we look at the other qualities that we need, such as openness, such as creativity, we're not really going to find them there. So I do welcome this, and I do welcome the focus on all sorts of learning and studying, all different sorts of qualification.
Thank you, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod.